Some people have the power to change things, to make other people pay attention, to ask the hard questions, to shake up the system, maybe even to leverage the course of events. When I heard Tim DeChristopher speak last summer, I sensed that he was that kind of person. Tim is one of us, one of ours, a member of the Unitarian Universalist Congregation out in Salt Lake City. The talk that I heard was a fundraiser for his legal defense, because by that time he had already been convicted of the crime that would launch him into a kind of environmental celebrity. While protesting a Bureau of Land Management auction, leasing oil and gas rights to sensitive acreage near Arches National Park back in the waning days of 2008, the then 27-year-old DeChristopher had strolled inside the federal building in Salt Lake City to cool off and get a drink of water when a woman asked him if he were there to participate in the bidding. And when he answered yes, he was handed a bidder's paddle. Now, these auctions were intended for cronies in the oil business. That fall, just 3 months earlier, the New York Times had reported that Department of Interior regulators were taking bribes of drugs and sex from the very oil companies they were supposed to be monitoring them. Ken Salazar, who was named the new head of Interior when the administration changed hands, told ABC News that at the end of the day, the Bush administration was trying to get as much public land leased for oil and gas as they possibly could. Some of this land, our land, was being sold off essentially in perpetuity for as little as $2 an acre, which is why DeChristopher was there with the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance to demonstrate, not to participate in this auction. So for half an hour, he just watched the proceedings, took it all in, and then the University of Utah undergraduate decided to raise his paddle, which made the other bidders go higher, and Tim began to sense his power. Several times he forced the other speculators to pay more for the parcels, and then suddenly, unexpectedly, Tim started winning. So that by the end of the day, bidder number 70, as he became known, was the proud owner of 22,500 acres of prime wilderness valued at $1.8 million. As I said, when I heard him speak last summer, DeChristopher had already been convicted of making false statements and violating other federal laws. He was facing a potentially stiff sentence. So when he came into the auditorium, I was glad to see that he looked like a bulldozer. Shaved head, massive neck, of biceps bulging from under a black t-shirt inscribed with the words "peaceful uprising." This, I thought, was a guy who could survive the slammer. And then when he started speaking, I was even more impressed. Full paragraphs, grammatical constructions, 90 minutes without notes of informed, cogent analysis of the ecological crisis that's threatening our planet and the political quagmire that keeps us from doing anything about it. DeChristopher shared a little of his own story. He said the turning point for him came when he attended a lecture by Stanford biology professor Terry Root, who'd received a Nobel Prize for being part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. a report that concluded that global warming had become an inevitability, that many of its worst effects, from acidifying oceans to massive extinctions, had basically become unavoidable. Even the best case scenarios for our planet were not pretty to contemplate. After this lecture, Tim came forward. He asked Dr. Root if there was not anything that could be done to forestall this catastrophe, and she said, "Sorry, no." Instead of being demoralized by that answer, De Christopher was energized. We have to let ourselves be shattered by the hopelessness of this crisis, he'd say. When we abandon hope that things will work out, the hope that we can still live the comfortable, easy lives we've been promised, the hope that somebody else is going to solve this problem, then we become free to act. For him, abandoning hope meant realizing that incrementalism was not working. Changing light bulbs and recycling were not going to forestall this crisis. Working around the edges of partisan politics, hoping that maybe the Democrats would be less bad than the Republicans, was not going to stop the planet from continuing to heat for the next 100 years. More drastic, forceful actions were needed. And if that meant breaking the law, so be it, as he told the court. The power of the Justice Department is based on its ability to take things away from people, to take away their liberty and their property, maybe even their lives. The more that people feel they have nothing to lose, the more that power shrivels. The opposite of hope, Tim said, is not despair, it's empowerment. Now, I suggested a few minutes ago that some people have power to change things, and Tim De Christopher wants us to believe that we all share this power. His message is as much about grassroots democracy as about environmentalism. His speech was peppered with references to the founding fathers and jury nullification and freedom riders in the South and, of course, civil disobedience. This is a tactic that makes sense to Tim after growing up in Appalachia. When he was a child, his mother was active in the Sierra Club, as he explains. "My mom was one of those who pursued every legal avenue for making the coal industry follow the law. She commented at hearings, she wrote petitions, she filed lawsuits, but Massey Energy had bought and paid for all the judges of West Virginia. That company had broken the law thousands of times. They had killed their own miners. They'd poisoned the people living downstream. They'd barely paid a penalty because they dished out millions to the politicians of the state." As a native of West Virginia, De Christopher told the court, "I've seen from a young age that exploitation of fossil fuels has always gone hand in hand with the exploitation of the local people. In West Virginia, we have been extracting coal longer than anyone else. And after 150 years of making other people rich, West Virginia is almost dead last in per capita income, education, life expectancy, and this is not an anomaly. The areas with the richest fossil fuel resources, whether coal in West Virginia and Kentucky or oil in Mississippi and Louisiana, are the areas with the lowest standards of living. And in part, he says, this is a necessity of the industry. The only way to convince someone to blow up their backyard or poison their own water is to make them so desperate they don't have any other options. But it's also the nature of the economic model, because fossil fuels are a limited resource. Whoever controls access to that resource in the beginning gets to set all the terms. They set the terms for their workers, for the local communities, even apparently for the regulatory agencies. But in contrast, you cannot own the sun or the wind or the tides in quite the same way that you can own an oil field, Tim explains. You cannot hoard or monopolize the sunlight. So the rewards from harnessing energy from renewables are more likely to go to the people who actually do the work. It's a less centralized system, so it has more democratic outcomes. When somebody in the audience that night asked Tim during the question and answer if he thought capitalism might be the problem, Tim explained that he had his degree in economics, and he did not think that our United States was currently a capitalist economy, at least not one with the kind of competitive markets that Adam Smith originally envisioned. And he explained that competitive market was the term that Smith used. He never spoke about free markets. And to be competitive, according to Smith, prices actually have to reflect the costs of the goods produced. You can't just externalize your costs. You can't just send your filth up a smokestack into the air and let other generations or people in other states pay the bill for that. America right now, Tim said, could use a little old-fashioned capitalism. Rather radical suggestion. Instead of capitalism, he called our current economy a form of corporate nationalism. That was his term. Moneyed interest had become so thoroughly enmeshed and intertwined with government that there was no separating the two, which is why ordinary citizens often feel they're hard-pressed to make a difference, because while politicians call themselves public servants, they're not serving you and me or most of the public most of the time. They're serving their paymasters, the big donors, the lobbyists. Consequently, he says, one of the dominant characteristics of the climate movement is a sense of disempowerment. We're fighting against these entrenched interests, against the richest, most powerful corporations in the world, often in collusion with our own government. This is a David and Goliath matchup. But little people, ordinary people, do have power, De Christopher insists. They just don't realize it. From a disempowered perspective, he says, we look at the opinion polls and we think, oh, only so much of the population agrees with us. Maybe 10 or 15% really understand the urgency of the issue, and folks begin to feel helpless because we're in a minority. We're missing the fact that even if 10 or 15% of the United States population really gets the issue of climate change, that is 30 or 40 million people. This is more than enough to bring the fossil fuel industry to its knees. If a tenth of those people were willing to engage in significant nonviolent civil disobedience, this becomes an incredible force. De Christopher asks us to consider, for example, what would happen if 100 people every day, day in and day out, decided to stop the machines doing mountaintop removal in his home state of West Virginia. As disillusioned as he is with the current administration, which is taking a tough line on his prosecution, Tim thinks that if push came to shove, a peaceful, unarmed protesters versus Massey coal, not even Obama would send in federal troops to defend the permanent scarring and denuding of Appalachia. In an interview with Brooks Jarvis, Tim referenced Václav Havel, a leader of the revolution in Czechoslovakia in 1989, who spoke about how the first most important thing they did in overcoming that tyrannical regime was just to start acting as if they were living in a free and democratic society. They basically started pretending that they had a sort of democratic power, and that pretending made it come true. Or look at Egypt. It was the people in Tahrir Square all along who had the power, not Mubarak. In Egypt, Tim says, once they made the decision they were going to be a force, there was no stopping them, because fundamental change begins in the mind. It doesn't begin in the streets. It doesn't start on the barricades. It begins in our consciousness and in the decision to act when enough people begin to consciously take responsibility for their own future. Amazing things can happen. Now, crazy talk like that is what landed Mr. De Christopher in a federal prison, spending most of the last month in an 8-by-10-foot isolation cell. Shortly after I heard him speak last July, he was sentenced to 2 years behind bars, $10,000 fine, and 3 years of probation. At his trial, his attorneys were not allowed to tell the jury that over the years there'd been dozens of bidders who'd walked away from the parcels they'd bought without paying. They were never prosecuted for that, but of course those were industry insiders. The jury wasn't allowed to hear that by that time De Christopher had actually managed to raise $80,000 to begin paying for the land he'd purchased, to buy it outright, because the court ruled by that time the fraud had already occurred. The jury was not allowed to hear his necessity defense, that what he was trying to do was stop an illegal auction because Bureau of Land Management was not following its own statutory requirements to do an assessment of the impact on air quality in nearby national monuments. Tim was not allowed to make any political appeals or statements to the jury. But then his politics were very much taken into account when it came time for sentencing. Judge D.V. Benson called his actual crime not that bad, but made it clear that De Christopher's, quote, continuing trail of statements was the real offense for which he was being punished. In other words, Tim was getting an extra stiff sentence for exercising his First Amendment rights, which makes him, in my mind, a political prisoner. I have no desire to go to prison, De Christopher said at his hearing. Any assertion that I want to be even a temporary martyr is false. What I want is for you to join me in standing up for the right and responsibility of citizens to challenge their government. I want you to join me in valuing this country's rich history of nonviolent civil disobedience. Quite a few people seemed to be listening and taking those words to heart, because just a few months after he went to jail, over 1,200 individuals, including Bill McKibben, were arrested in Washington, D.C. in an attempt to stop the XL pipeline, the largest direct action in the environmental movement's history. They managed at least to slow the XL project, which would tap oil from Canada's vast tar sands, and which James Fallon, NASA's top climate scientist, said would be basically a game over for our planet. Obama, as usual, waffled, initially putting the pipeline on hold, then saying he wanted to fast-track construction of the southern leg. This month, what's called the 99% spring is trying to train 100,000 people to do civil disobedience to stop this juggernaut of climate change. In 2 weeks, on May 5th, International Climate Action Day will join people from all over the world, citizens on every continent uniting to bring about change. At this point of unimaginable threats on the horizon, this is what hope looks like, De Christopher told the court. In these times of a morally bankrupt government that sold out its own principles, this is what patriotism looks like. With countless lives on the line, this is what love looks like, and it will only grow. Tim's words and his actions inspire me, sharing as I do this spiritual heritage of dissent from Henry Thoreau to Susan B. Anthony to James Reeb. Unitarian Universalists claim a long history of breaking the law in obedience to higher authority. But the question is, how far outside our comfort zones are we willing to go? How much is any one of us personally willing to risk? What do our religious principles require of us in these times to defend our Mother Earth? Tim's final words to the judge before being led to prison are a challenge to us all. The choice you are making is which side you are on.